If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
In Sacramento.
Politics have been mostly off the table for many Venezuelans, in public places, in social media, in places they can be heard and seen.
The world is focused on Venezuela right now.
What is day-to-day life like inside the country?
We'll talk to a journalist on the ground in Caracas.
For Tuesday, December 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsie Chang. A once fringe idea has become more and more mainstream in American politics.
That's the idea of reverse migration.
What it means is ethnically cleansing or forcibly deporting from traditionally white countries everybody who's not white. That's the idea.
And 20% of American adults say their mental health is poor.
Being a caregiver is really taking a drain on people's mental health, financial uncertainty, the state of the world.
We'll take you inside the numbers of a new survey and tell you what they mean.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. A federal judge in San Jose is set to decide whether to block Trump administration arrests of people attending immigration court hearings and check-in appointments. As KQED's senior immigration editor Tyke Hendricks reports, that's after hearings today in two related cases.
Since May, federal agents have been handcuffing asylum seekers and others in courthouse hallways and ICE check-ins, even those who'd been released to pursue their immigration claims. The government says it's following the law, but advocates say such arrests are unprecedented, arbitrary, and illegal. ACLU attorney Bree Bernwanger is asking U.S. District Judge Casey Pitts to halt the arrests.
Just imagine if the government changed a law and all of a sudden you could be thrown in jail at any time. Imagine how that would harm you. That's how it harms our clients.
Pitt says he will rule as quickly as possible. I'm Tyke Hendricks, KQED News.
California data centers are being built in communities already burdened by environmental hazards. That's according to a new report out today. KQED climate reporter Laura Clivens has more.
Data centers are essential to powering the AI boom. The report found the centers are often sited in areas with unhealthy air, limited groundwater, and high levels of hazardous waste. It highlights existing and planned data centers in San Francisco's Bayview-Hunters Point neighborhood. Lily Ganges is with the Kaper Foundation, which authored the study.
There's a lot of disparities already in health factors, environmental factors that cannot be ignored.
The report says the centers can add air pollution, use large amounts of water, and leak hazardous waste. Both Bayview Hunters Point data centers did not respond to requests for comment. I'm Laura Clivens, KQED News.
A student group at UC Berkeley is planning a silent protest tomorrow in support of a lecturer who's reportedly being suspended after advocating for Palestine. That lecturer, Perrin Cao, held a hunger strike for 38 days this fall. He told KQED's podcast The Bay in October he thought it was relevant to teaching computer science.
If you're going to learn all these tools to, you know, write these programs and train these large AI models, what are those going to be used for? Are they going to be used to mass surveil Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza? These are things that we have to be thinking critically about.
In a statement, a spokesperson told KQED that the UC can't comment on personnel matters, but it will, quote, always take a viewpoint-neutral approach when it comes to supporting freedom of expression. Recent changes to California's landmark climate program known as Cap and Invest could bring mixed results for consumer affordability, according to a new report from the state's legislative analyst. KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati has more.
Under Cap and Invest, refineries and factories have to pay for the ability to pollute in California. Changes approved by Governor Gavin Newsom and the legislature this fall put a stricter cap on carbon emissions to help the state meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals. The legislative analyst report says that could drive up the price of carbon, which could result in higher gas prices. But the report finds other changes to the program could help affordability, like an increase to the credit that Californians receive on their electric bills. I'm Guy Marzorati, KQED News.
Negotiations between roughly 1,500 striking teachers and the West Contra Costa Unified School District are set to resume today in Richmond in the strike's fourth day. Francisco Ortiz is president of the United Teachers of Richmond. He told a crowd of supporters today that public pressure forced the district back to the table.
And today we will bargain again with them at 3 p.m. so that they can bring forward an agreement that brings respectability and improved conditions for our members and for our students.
The district says the two sides remain far apart on financial details, with a gap of roughly $80 million between the offers. Officials say their most recent offer would cost $103 million, while the union's counterproposal would cost more than $180 million. There's more news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from San Francisco Bay University, offering degree programs in tech and business for a world shaped by AI, sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography, Kauffman.org, and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Second Harvest of Silicon Valley, providing nutritious food to 1 in 6 people in Santa Clara and San Mateo counties. Learn more at shfb.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Tomorrow, Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado will be in Oslo to collect the Nobel Peace Prize. Machado has spent the past year in hiding inside the country she hopes to one day lead. The Nobel Committee noted, quote, serious threats against her life in their announcement that she had won the prize. And all of this has played out as the U.S. military has ramped up its presence near Venezuela to pressure the government and also attack roughly 24 alleged drug vessels. So the rest of the world is putting a lot of focus on Venezuela right now, and we wanted to get a sense of what the past year has been like inside the country. To do that, we are joined from Caracas by Venezuelan journalist Tony Frangi. He heads the newsletter Venezuela Weekly. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much. It's an honor for me to be here.
Let me just start with the Nobel Prize. How much do you think people in Caracas will be following the presentation tomorrow? We'll be talking and thinking about that.
I think it's a very important topic of conversation here, even though it's not a very public one because of the state of affairs in the country. But many Venezuelans are expecting to see if Maria Corina actually managed to leave Venezuela for Oslo, as she said. I think that's one of the main reasons people are watching and following the news of the prize, but also the fact that these are very big news for us, and many people see them as the result of the struggle and the democratic fight that many Venezuelans have been enduring for the last year in the country after the July 28 elections of 2024.
When you talk about a lot of conversation but not too public about it, give me a sense of what that looks like. Is that just a side conversation? Is that just on your phone but not in public on social media? Like what's the best way to understand that and why?
So after the elections happened and the opposition managed to prove that their official results were not the one shown by the polling station machines, the government proceeded with a bigger crackdown on civil society. And since then, politics have been mostly off the table for many Venezuelans in public places, in social media, in places it can be heard and seen. So it has become more or less a conversation within family or within private circles. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's reports of journalists, of radio journalists who were fired from their jobs because they reported of the Nobel Peace Prize.
Really?
So in a way, there's a lot of sense of fear due to repression and a lot of self-censorship in Venezuelans that has forced many of these conversations and topics to more private and intimate spaces.
I want to talk about the election in a moment, but on this topic of what conversation is like and censorship and self-censorship, what is being said or thought and talked about when it comes to all of this U.S. military pressure? Is that front and center, or is that also an on-the-margins conversation?
It's especially on the margins because the government also has a heightened sense of paranoia due to the constant U.S. air incursions and, of course, the warships in the coast. So what we've seen is a mix between people whispering their opinions or what they think and more or less a generalized sense of denial with the situation. For many Venezuelans, the only solution is to keep forward with their lives as it is, especially with rising inflation, especially with a increasingly worse economic situation during the holiday seasons. So sometimes people wouldn't think that a country that is supposedly on the brink of war, you can find, I don't know, Christmas fairs or Halloween parties or new stores opening up and people just going to buy stuff there for Christmas. But it's what's happening, because for many, the only solution is to just keep on with their daily lives and try to act as if nothing is happening, because I feel that many Venezuelans won't really consider this to be a bluff until something actually happens. It's been 25 years of constant political upheaval. So for many, it's just, you know, another check in the long list.
Yeah. Do you see any physical signs of preparations for any sort of military conflict?
Not as much. The government has moved certain assets to the cause. They have moved machinery to take down planes to military bases. There has been a mobilization of the militia. But beyond that, the city more or less remains perhaps more militarized, perhaps with more policemen, but more or less life remains the same in Venezuela at this point. We're having practically weekly incursions of F-18 or B-2 planes from the U.S., and it's just become like another normal thing. We actually had one today, and people are just going on with their lives because it has already become a weekly thing for more than a few months.
Mm-hmm. You know, NPR has been trying to report from Venezuela, but has not been granted permission to enter the country. What is one thing about life in Venezuela today that you feel like people listening to this should know, that you wish you could tell more people about?
Well, I would say, firstly, that if you see a country with baseball stadiums full of people and people doing Christmas shopping, it doesn't mean that that country is not in crisis or that that country is not following politics, but rather that countries with crisis, with political conflicts, even with war, people there, they try to continue their lives as it is. And it's two things that can coexist despite how bizarre it can look. And on the other hand, I would say that people should sometimes give more voice to Venezuelans and listen to Venezuelans. I feel U.S. media has focused itself mostly on foreign analysts on the country. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been much space for voices of Venezuelans. And I think that's important, especially because, as I said, many Venezuelans are self-silencing themselves or doing self-censorship. And that is definitely generating a bias in their reporting. So I would say that they should consider that Venezuelans' opinions are more varied and diverse than they think. And definitely many times they will clash with what many in the U.S. think should happen or think is happening in Venezuela.
Well, we were really happy to talk to you about it. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much.
That is Venezuelan journalist Tony Frangi joining us from Caracas. Thank you.
Raul Malo, the lead vocalist for the band The Mavericks, has died. According to a statement from Malo's family, he died on Monday evening at the age of 60. With a career lasting over four decades, Malo had one of the most recognizable voices in American country and roots music. NPR Music's Felix Contreras says his band The Mavericks challenged expectations, with Malo's voice leading the way.
It was one of the most unlikely stories in American music. Raul Malo, a first-generation American who was the child of Cuban immigrants and who grew up in Miami, became a country music star.
There goes my heart, breaking in two.
The band he formed in 1989 was called The Mavericks, and it lived up to its name. The band blended country, rock and roll, folk music, jump blues, Latin music, and an occasional Cajun beat into its distinct sound. In 1995, Malo told WHYY's Fresh Air that the inspiration for that musical mashup came from his Cuban immigrant parents.
I grew up in a pretty musical household, so there was all kinds of music around, always. We listened to everything from Hank Williams to Celia Cruz to Sam Cooke to Bobby Darin. It didn't matter.
In an interview with NPR in 1992, Raul Malo explained that the wide-open musical appreciation he experienced at home wasn't exactly appreciated in Cuban Miami, and yet his experiences held some life lessons that would shape his musical destiny.
I guess I was, you know, real different. And I never even realized, and I didn't know why at the time, you know. And it was pretty painful, you know, sometimes, you know, because you kind of felt like, well, you know, you don't really belong. But now that I think about it, you kind of learn to depend on one person, and that's yourself.
That deviating from the norm allowed him and the band to slide between genres, and they eventually found a legion of true believers in their sound. And in addition to following his instincts, it was that voice that set Raul Malo and the Mavericks apart. From Heartbreaking Ballads.
Without a love of my own.
To country-tinged tales of nostalgia and loss.
I wanna go across the river to the house on Old Way Road where my life began and ended all the same.
To full-on western swing barn-burning rave-ups.
I've been drinking cold coffee at a diner in Baton Rouge.
His voice charmed just about anyone who heard it, and along the way, Malo and the Mavericks collected awards and recognition from the Academy of Country Music, the Country Music Association, a slew of Grammy nominations in the country categories, and eventually the Trailblazer Award from the Americana Music Association. And in 2020, his distinctive rich baritone was finally heard in Spanish on the Mavericks album called Appropriately en Español. Malo explained to reporter Julie Height in August of that year that his bilingual childhood in Miami was part of the inspiration for the album.
I'm first generation Cuban American in my family. I was the first child born in the New World. You had to learn English and you had to speak English, and it was part of the curriculum and everybody spoke it. And at home I spoke Spanish to my abuelita, and that was fine by me.
And when the sun goes down, your memory still hanging round.
Raul Malo's career reminds us that the roots of American music go deep and wide. And yet he didn't feel like he belonged exclusively to one genre.
To qualify the Mavericks as just a country band is probably a bit unfair, not only to the Mavericks, but to country bands. I don't consider myself a country music artist. I just consider myself a singer-songwriter and who every once in a while writes a country song and does the Grand Ole Opry, which I love doing every once in a while.
The fact that a Cuban-American kid from Miami grew up to perform in that cathedral of country music says everything about Raul Malo and the rewards of doing things on his own terms. Felix Contreras, NPR News.
I see your emerald eyes, your ruby lips on mine, remembering all the love.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 6:18 starts with trouble in Richmond. Here's Julie Depesh.
Here, looking at a couple of vehicles here at eastbound 80 before El Portal Drive. They're blocking the left lanes back up to Cutting Boulevard. New trouble on the peninsula, north 101 before South Airport Boulevard. A wreck in the second lane for the left has you pretty slow from San Bruno Avenue. Some better news, that three-vehicle crash Mountain View on south 101 before Shoreline finally cleared that from the lanes. Still a tough back up to Oregon Expressway. Julie Depesh for KQ.
Julie, we'll have another update in 10 minutes. Traffic support comes from Glime, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Cover Up from Citizen 4 director Laura Poitras. With access to notes from reporter Seymour Hirsch, this documentary captures the process and power of investigative journalism on Netflix December 26th, awards eligible. And from the Cal Privacy. From enforcing privacy laws to educating Californians on how to exercise their privacy rights, Cal Privacy is working hard to make privacy easy. Learn more at privacy.ca.gov.
clinics are popping up all over offering ketamine in a variety of settings for depression, for anxiety, for chronic pain. There isn't a real standardized approach to how to treat someone using ketamine. Experts kind of describe this moment as the Wild West. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm a health correspondent for KQED. You can find my story about ketamine at kqed.org.
You ever wonder where all the hundreds of billions of dollars are coming from that are funding this AI boom?
I don't even think Americans are necessarily unfamiliar with this concept. We might have even heard of it previously as a shadow bank.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, paying the tab on AI. Next time on Marketplace.
Stay with us for Marketplace coming up this evening at 6:30. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. Subaru. The Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru. More than a car company, and the listeners of KQED.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. After an Afghan national was charged in the ambush of two National Guardsmen last month in Washington, D.C., the U.S. has further restricted immigration from 19 countries. President Trump has also revived a call for, quote, reverse migration, a once fringe idea that has become a mantra for this administration. NPR domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef joins us now to talk about all of this. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so where exactly within this administration are you seeing these calls for reverse migration or re-migration, as it's sometimes referred to, right?
Right. So President Trump on Thanksgiving Day posted to social media about how immigration policies have hurt, quote, gains in living conditions for many. And he said only reverse migration can fully cure this situation. But also the State Department's proposed reorganization plan included a new office of remigration. And the Department of Homeland Security has called for remigration on social media posts. One of them, for example, Elsa, with simply the word remigrate.
Okay, so what does remigrate exactly mean?
Well, here's how Heidi Byrick explained it to me. She's with the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism.
Basically, what it means is ethnically cleansing or forcibly deporting from traditionally white countries everybody who's not white. That's the idea.
The idea is often attributed to a French novelist who became known as the originator of the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which is this baseless claim that white Christian Europeans are being systematically replaced by immigrants in an attempt to dilute European or Western cultures. And remigration was the solution he proposed. And the idea was that it would be a kind of organized removal of immigrants and even the children of immigrants. And also, these were fringe ideas earlier this century, but they are now associated with a movement that cuts across Europe known as the Identitarian Movement, and which has increasingly informed party politics there and here.
Right now. Okay, so talk more about that. Like, how have these ideas become mainstream today?
So the change is largely attributed to an extreme right Austrian political activist named Martin Sellner. He's a former neo-Nazi, and now he heads up an international network called Generation Identity. And he has worked to bring terms like remigration into popular discourse. I spoke to Julia Ebner about this. She heads the Violent Extremism Lab at the University of Oxford, and she has sat in on strategy sessions for identitarian groups. She says they staged events to create uncertainty and fear, because then they found that people were more open to their extreme ideas.
The strategy was all about controlled provocation and strategic polarization. So they were launching media stunts in the streets of from Vienna to Berlin to Paris, where they tried to generate as much media attention as they could possibly get from, for example, simulating a terrorist attack in the heart of Vienna or putting a burqa on top of an old statue. So their idea was to really to provoke strategically and step by step to move the Overton window.
The Overton window, Elsa, refers to the range of policy ideas that the public considers acceptable. Remigration for a long time fell outside that window, but that's no longer true.
No longer true. I mean, it is interesting that these ideas are so strongly associated with Europe. Like, how did they take root here in the U.S. then?
So, a personal story. Years ago, I was interviewing someone who was in charge of recruitment in the Midwest for a group called Identity Europa, which at the time was the U.S.-based identitarian group. And I remember asking him, how did he think the U.S. would become a white nation, if not with violence? And he said he thought people would just re-migrate. I think that was the first time I heard the term. And it sounded ridiculous to me. You know, why would millions of people who had put down stakes just willingly uproot?
Yeah.
Well, years later, remigration has been operationalized. We are seeing it with immigration operations in L.A., Chicago, Charlotte, New Orleans, and so on. I did some reporting from Chicago about, you know, the disorder, the tear gas, the pepper guns, military-style raids and beatings that occurred in that operation in places that didn't normally see those things. And so it has been clear that the removal of people is violent.
But what are you hearing, Odette, from White House officials when they are being asked why they are using terms that are adopted by white nationalists?
The White House, the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department all rejected or didn't acknowledge the European extremist roots of this policy idea when I asked them about it. But I think it's important also to add the context of other terms that this administration has been using, you know, talking about Western values, Western civilization, chiding European allies for making themselves vulnerable to civilizational suicide or civilizational erasure. Bayrick says this is language that sits firmly within the rhetoric of the identitarian and broader white nationalist movement.
That is NPR's Odette Youssef. Thank you so much, Odette.
Thank you.
In Hong Kong, authorities are vowing to conduct a transparent investigation into how at least 160 people died in one of the deadliest fires there in decades. But as NPR's Emily Fang reports, authorities are also arresting and detaining people who have called for accountability over the blaze.
After a massive fire burned down 7 of the 8 high-rise buildings in a Hong Kong residential complex, investigators are looking into the substandard plastic netting and styrofoam boards which encase the buildings. One student named Miles Kwan started a petition for an independent inquiry.
He made very mild demands that even pro-Beijing figures in Hong Kong would agree to.
This is Chris Chang, a longtime Hong Kong journalist who's been covering the tragedy. He notes the student was briefly arrested over the petition. For Hong Kong authorities, he says,
stability is more important than anything.
And over the weekend, Hong Kong's National Security Office summoned foreign journalists to warn them not to smear the state's response to the fire. Chang says all this erodes public trust, including the fact that the Investigations Committee authorities have assembled has no statutory power.
This kind of committee would not have the legal power to summon people, companies, or officials.
Hong Kong police and local media say Beijing's national security law has been used to arrest at least 4 people so far over statements or actions asking for more accountability over the fire. Thomas Kellogg, executive director of the Center for Asian Law at Georgetown University, says the use of the national security law here is likely intentional.
They give the government more or less a blank check on whom they can arrest, how long they can hold them, and even limits on their basic due process rights. So this is a powerful tool to control and even repress criticism.
Operations for Hong Kong Baptist University's student union were also suspended over the weekend after they organized a commemorative bulletin board for fire victims. Historian Rowena He studies Chinese political movements, especially Beijing's crackdown in Tiananmen Square in 1989. And as she watched the fallout from the Hong Kong fire, she says she started to cry at the parallels she saw.
Watching all of this happen in the past 35 years since Tiananmen, you saw that it happened again and again and again, and they're coming after Hong Kong.
Historically, she says, the whistleblowers are always punished. Emily Fang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Large swaths of cash are flowing in and out of the AI industry. That's one of the stories coming up on Marketplace after your traffic update starting in the North Bay. Here's Julie Deppish.
We're heading to northbound 101 after Tamalpais Drive. That's where an SUV and a pickup truck collided, both on the shoulder now, but it was already a crawl back to Marin City. Better news for Napa. They've cleared that overturned big rig from Highway 29 southbound between Saskill Ferry Road and Highway 221. So all lanes are finally open. Trying to put out a car fire, Lafayette, eastbound 24 after Akilanis Road. Fire crews are now blocking the right lane. Slow into Oakland. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Berkeley Rep, presenting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays. A special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org. And from Postman. Used by over 40 million developers, Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs to help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions from design to delivery. More information at postman.com. It's 6:30.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
On the program today, the bond market, AI, small businesses, and Botox, in that order. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bitwarden, with a reminder that strengthening account security with a password manager can help users stay safer on all devices during this season of giving and all year long. Learn more at bitwarden.com. And by Ninja One, helping organizations manage, protect, and support every device and every user, all from one platform that automates IT and strengthens security. More at ninjaone.com. And by Solidigm. Today's AI ambitions require a different approach to storage. Solidigm offers solid-state storage solutions optimized for AI with higher capacities, greater speed, and energy efficiency. StorageForAI.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 9th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We all want to know which way the economy's going, right? I think that's a pretty uncontroversial thing to say. And to find out, you could, for instance, ask an economist friend what they think, maybe a Wall Street banker if you know one, or better yet, a small business person. You could also clue into the Federal Reserve tomorrow when the central bank is going to release its summary of economic projections where they think rates and a bunch of other parameters are headed. You could also, though, if you are of a mind, look at the bond market. Demand for short-term treasury bills and longer-term bonds at either end of what is known as the yield curve can tell us a lot about what investors are expecting. But there is a part of that yield curve that we don't often talk about, medium-term treasury, sometimes known as the belly of the curve. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports now to get us going, that belly has been sending some signals of its own.
The government issues treasuries that mature in anywhere from less than a year to 10 and even 30 years. So the belly of the curve is basically everything in the middle.
We tend to focus on two-year and five-year notes.
That's Chris Lowe, chief economist at FHN Financial. He says yields on treasuries in that belly of the curve are influenced by what investors expect the Federal Reserve to do in that 2 to 5 year time frame.
They anticipate. So when we talk about the Fed might cut rates at an upcoming meeting or they might not, well, we're anticipating not just the next one, but the next several years worth.
Investors know that the Federal Reserve is still trying to bring rates down to a neutral level to support full employment and stable inflation. And if investors think interest rates are going to keep falling, they're more likely to buy those bonds today. But Lowe says over the last couple of weeks, demand for treasuries within that belly of the curve has eased off a bit.
When we look at the pricing of interest rates in the belly of the curve, it partly reflects a debate within the trading community, within the Federal Reserve itself, about just exactly where is neutral.
Over the last couple months, expectations for economic growth have picked up. John Canavan, Lead market analyst at Oxford Economics says the tax incentives in the budget law passed this year are expected to stimulate consumer spending.
That same act has also resulted in significant investment benefits for corporations, which is likely to improve capital expenditures next year, which should help economic growth.
And if economic growth continues to pick up and inflation sticks around?
That actually means the Fed is likely to cut rates, you know, less.
That's Kathy Bosjancic, chief economist at Nationwide. She says bond markets are only expecting 2 cuts next year. And beyond that?
We think that then we settle into a neutral level and it could be there for a while.
In other words, the belly of the curve is suggesting that rate cuts could be coming to an end. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, once again, I know I'm a broken record here. Traders were waiting on the Fed. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, tell the truth here. Before the financial crisis and the Great Recession, did you know what a mortgage-backed security was? Had you ever heard of a credit default swap? If I'd have asked you whether Lehman Brothers was an investment bank or a chain of auto body shops, which would you have guessed? Well, investment bank, probably most of you. But the point is, every bubble has its own jargon and its own terms of art that, when things are bubbling up, they become common parlance on Wall Street. After things pop, though, all that jargon makes its way into our Main Street vocabulary. And you can perhaps guess where I'm going here. There's plenty of debate about whether we're even in an AI bubble, let alone its poppability. But just in case things do go south, Marketplace's Matt Levin has 3 early candidates for the bubble buzzwords we hope you are not going to be learning in the near future.
Just to reassure you a bit, very few experts I interviewed think we're on the precipice of some global economic meltdown like the Great Recession. But on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being, I'm getting major 2008 heebie-jeebies here, just how worried are those experts?
I'd say I think it's between 5 to 7.
I'll say probably 7 or 8 at least.
I'm probably in the middle of that range, at a 4 or a 5.
Okay, so maybe not that reassuring. Gil Luria at the investment firm D.A. Davidson, the 4 or 5 guy, says if things do go haywire, you'll probably hear these words a lot.
Special purpose vehicle.
Special purpose vehicle, or SPV as the cool kids call it. Even very rich tech companies sometimes need to borrow money to build an AI data center. So when Meta announced it was building a nearly $30 billion data center in Louisiana earlier this year, it wasn't surprising there was lots of debt involved.
Now, this isn't Meta borrowing the money.
Technically, it's a special purpose vehicle borrowing the money, a separate legal entity Meta co-created with a private investment firm. Meta is agreeing to rent the data center.
So that would be like you buying a house, but not taking the mortgage yourself, but having somebody else take the mortgage, which from your perspective is great.
But from a broader economic perspective, maybe not so great. The fraudulent energy company Enron was a big fan of special purpose vehicles. Now, there's nothing inherently illegal about SPVs, but if demand to use that Louisiana data center falls short of expectations,
it's Meta borrowing money without borrowing money, and at the end of the day, somebody's going to be left holding the bag.
Which brings us to AI bubble buzzword number 2.
Private credit.
Advait Aaron is at the Center for Public Enterprise. He was the 5 to 7 guy on the doomsday scale. Private credit is basically investment firms like hedge funds and private equity lending money to businesses, like a bank would. Except they're not regulated like banks.
I don't even think Americans are necessarily unfamiliar with this concept. We might have even heard of it previously as a shadow bank.
That data center in Louisiana Meta is building with that special purpose vehicle, a private credit firm is throwing in billions, which is the case for a lot of AI financing.
These chips that companies like Nvidia make, they help those tech companies buy those chips, and they help the data center developers take out long-term debt or construction debt to build the data centers themselves.
If the AI bubble goes pop, private credit will be hit pretty hard. That's bad news for the pension funds whose money private credit firms invest, but it could also be bad news for actual non-shadow banks.
So banks are actually funding private credit and are getting some amount of returns from private credit. And private credit uses banks' funding to go and raise other debt or other capital and goes and makes their risky bets.
Private credit, special purpose vehicle. Admittedly, these buzzwords sound so boring. Isn't there a new sexy sci-fi sounding word that better befits a bubble tied to super intelligent robots?
Neocloud is a term that people might come to know.
Ooh, neocloud. Paul Kudrowski is a fellow at the MIT Institute for the Digital Economy. He was the expert most worried about the AI bubble. Neoclouds are tech companies that basically rent out AI chips to tech firms and often take out loans against the chips they're renting out.
These neocloud providers have very high debt loads, much of it at high yields, much of it that has to be turned over on a 4-year, 5-year basis. And so they're a very risky bunch.
CoreWeave is probably the most famous of the neoclouds. It started as a cryptocurrency company.
The analogy I sometimes make is they're like some of the more aggressive mortgage providers during the financial crisis who showed up to do only ninja loans, no income, no job, no asset loans.
There's already some signs neocloud companies are struggling. The price of insurance against CoreWeave defaulting on its debt went up by nearly 60% in 2 months. By the way, that insurance, well, it has a familiar name, credit default swaps. Remember those? Yeah, I tried to forget them too. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
What could possibly go wrong? We are going to be doing some coverage the next couple of months, the general gist of which will be, tell me if this sounds familiar, AI, too big to fail? Let us know what you want to know at marketplace.org. As we've said a couple of times the past couple of days on this program, we are never going to get the jobs report for October. That data has vanished into the black hole of the government shutdown, never to be seen again. We did, though, this morning get a slice of labor market data for the 10th month of the year in the form of the October JOLTS, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. Help wanted ads climbed to a 5-month high. That's good. Layoffs were up too, though, and people were less likely to change jobs. And more top of mind, given the calendar, the outplacement firm Challenger Green Christmas says announced job cuts in retail are up nearly 140% from the same period last year. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has the holiday retail cautionary tale.
Last year, David Swartz, an analyst at Morningstar, toured a new warehouse that Ulta, the cosmetics chain, had recently opened.
And there's very few people working in there. The people are sort of there to monitor the machines.
The robots are efficient. They can unload, organize, and pack. From self-checkout at stores to AI at corporate headquarters, technology saves money, considering wages typically make up something like half of retailers' operating costs. And relying on machines means there's less seasonal hiring fuss.
Even the robot workers can be laid off to some degree when they're not needed.
This is the future of retail, says Steve Hockman at Nagarro.
We call it, in fancy terms, the great decoupling.
Usually in business, when revenue grows, hiring grows. There's more money to invest and expand.
But this holiday season, what we're seeing is a separation of those two trends.
Meaning now, even when a retailer's revenue increases, hiring typically falls. Companies are investing in other areas, like those robots, instead of in their headcount. Especially this year, brands have leaned hard into automation because of uncertainty in the economy, even though the holidays are kind of the worst time for job cuts. John Talbot teaches marketing at Indiana University.
For years, larger retailers have mostly avoided any form of layoffs during the holiday season. For, 15 years now, it's just bad press.
Because reporters like me are watching extra closely. Still, Target and Amazon have announced layoffs in the last several months. Talbot says between low consumer sentiment and tariffs, every dollar counts.
This is an odd year. I definitely think it's an odd year.
He says even if consumers spend like crazy, it'll at most slow the trend a tad. Inevitably, the great retail labor reshuffling is here. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I mentioned layoffs were up in October overall. In the information industry specifically, October a year ago, there were 34,000 layoffs. October this year, 48,000. This past September, we heard from Archit, who'd been laid off from his tech job back at the start of the year, around the same time that his parents were laid off too. So we got him back on the phone to hear how he and the family are faring.
I've been fortunate enough to have the opportunity to interview at a bunch of places and get a couple of offers and be able to choose between them. But that process has kind of taught me a lot about the job market as it currently is. I started interviewing in October after, again, putting in over 100 applications, but almost all of my interviews were to referrals. My first offer was actually at a startup, but it ended up, the pay was so low that out of respect for, I guess, myself, I just couldn't take that job because you're not even paying me a livable wage. Then it was a large Fortune 500 company. The thing with them is they're economically doing pretty poorly. And as I joined, I'm hearing news that they might do layoffs next year, and it's unclear what the future of the company is. So then that adds like a whole other layer. And even when I'm getting these offers, the economy weirdly doesn't feel stable enough that even if I start working, and I am working at one of these companies, that the opportunity is guaranteed for that long. Pretty much every parent I know between me and my friends who's in technology is laid off right now. My dad, he hasn't been able to find anything. And my mom, I think she just burnt out and she just isn't interested in looking anymore. So I see hope in the horizon in the sense that I think I will probably be able to get another job if I get laid off, but I don't really know anything about what's going to happen with my parents at the moment. And I don't really know the wider industry. Like, for people who are less fortunate than me, I wouldn't blame them for not having hope, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Archit, newly reemployed in the tech sector out in Phoenix, Arizona. Coming up.
And so when people are saying that they're going to get Botox, it might not be Botox.
Little did you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 179 today, 0.4%, closed at 47,560. The Nasdaq notched up 30 points, 0.1%, 23,576. The S&P 500 declined 6 points, about a 10%, 68.40. Cosmetics retailer Ulta Beauty, which Kristen mentioned, had a glow up to the tune of 2.3%. Target crept up 0.6%. Macy's rose 2%. Walmart climbed 1.3%. Costco Wholesale added 0.1%. Today, Campbell's reports today sales are down due to President Trump's tariffs, especially on the steel and aluminum that they need to make those iconic cans. The company also doesn't want to raise prices too much in this, and this is a quote, critical soup season. Campbell's sank 5.2% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
The numbers is supported by Odoo.com, your entire business on one platform. Marketplace is supported by Drexel University, whose cooperative education program provides students with opportunities to explore future careers and gain professional experience before graduation. More at drexel.edu. And by JumpCloud, simplifying IT through its intelligent, unified AI-backed platform that securely connects users to any resource from any device anywhere. JumpCloud, helping organizations prepare for AI acceleration.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. And from East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org. Good evening. It's 6:49. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Julie Depich will be here with your traffic update after Marketplace. And then at 7 o'clock on Fresh Air, the guest tonight is Rae Seehorn, star of the new series Pluribus. You may know her as the co-star of Better Call Saul, which was both the prequel and sequel to Breaking Bad. Pluribus has a sci-fi premise, but asks larger questions about happiness, anger, conformity, and resistance. That's on Fresh Air coming up at 7 here on KQED News.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Some news now from the world of small business, which I will set up by pointing out that according to the Small Business Administration, that's businesses with 500 employees or less account for give or take 2/3 of all new jobs in this economy. With that in mind, then, this. According to the most recent survey by the National Federation of Independent Business, first of all, and you probably expected this one, uncertainty is creeping up. It's up 3 points since October. That said, though, and uncertain though they are, small business owners remain optimistic, more optimistic than the historical average, in fact. Marketplace's Carla Javier squares that circle.
At Latchkey, a record store in South Philly, sales are up 60% this year, says owner Mark Folletti.
That's no joke. We feel really good about that.
That lines up with the latest survey of entrepreneurs like him.
Small businesses are generally doing really well in current economic conditions.
That's NFIB's Holly Wade. At the same time, she says, uncertainty is high. Hiring remains a concern, and inflation is affecting them too.
Especially in this last survey, where we saw far more small businesses saying that they raised prices in the last quarter.
Still, somehow, small business owners like Mark Folletti are optimistic.
I'm probably 58% optimistic, not quite maybe 60%, but more optimistic than pessimistic.
One potential explanation comes from John Arensmeyer of Small Business Majority.
If you're crazy enough to start and run a small business, you are by definition a very optimistic person.
His company did its own survey of small businesses too and found
what is different from the past is that the optimism and pessimism numbers are very close.
He says small businesses have been challenged by tariffs, increasing healthcare costs, and immigration operations. Erica Tapp Duran works with owners through the Temple University Small Business Development Center. She says they're doing okay, but are nervous.
They don't necessarily have deep capital reserves or access to large lines of credit. So the flow of commerce needs to be moving at a pretty good clip in order to keep operations sustainable.
Back at Latchkey, Mark Folletti says for now, he's leaning into used records and taking a hit on margins.
If I thought we were in this situation forever, where we were going to have tariffs and tumultuousness and total unpredictability, that might be a different ballgame.
Instead, he quit his other full-time job in hopes that next year at the store is as strong as last one was. I'm Carla Javier for Marketplace.
Love it or hate it, since its debut as a cosmetic treatment in 2002, Botox has become a household name, synonymous with the anti-aging hopes of millions. Sales matched those hopes, too, $2.7 billion last year in the cosmetics space. That said, Botox and its parent company are not enjoying the same prosperity they once did from that injectable. Madison Muller covers health and healthcare for Bloomberg, where she wrote about brand Botox. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I would like you to tell me, please, how you came to this story.
So I am one of our healthcare reporters here at Bloomberg, and that means I have the privilege of covering AbbVie, which is a pharmaceutical company and AbbVie is the maker of Botox. And one of the things that I've noticed over the last couple of quarters is that Botox was repeatedly missing analysts' estimates in terms of sales. And that to me was surprising because here in New York, it seems like everyone has Botox.
I'm in LA, Madison. I'm in LA here.
You get it too. Yeah. You get it, right. And so I was like, this doesn't make sense. Something doesn't add up. And I dug a little bit more into it, and that's sort of how I got into this story.
So what's going on? I mean, we talked a little bit about, not you and I, but somebody else, about med spas, you know, sort of these mm-hmm. days, you know, and people going to get touch-ups or what have you. It's not like Botox isn't being used more, or is it? What's the deal?
That is sort of the mystery that was part of this story. So the thing is, there are different types of neurotoxins now on the market. So Botox is the one that everyone's most familiar with, but Botox isn't the actual class of medications. And so there are other products on the market. There's one called Dysport. There's one called Xeomin, but it's like Kleenex. You know, everyone right. uses the word Botox to just describe the treatment. And so when people are saying that they're going to get Botox, it might not be Botox. And AbbVie or Allergan has really started to lose out on market share to some of these competitors.
Allergan and now AbbVie, they are not the first company to lose market share with their flagship product. What are they doing to bring it back?
So they are launching a pretty big marketing campaign. And one of those events I actually got to go to here in New York, it was an event called Naturally You. And this was more focused on filler, actually, which is a separate problem. Mm-hmm. But it shows the sort of consumer activation that AbbVie is doing right now to get consumers and customers back on their side, making sure that people know, you know, they've been around for so long. There's lots of studies, super safe, and it has a ton of different approved uses for, you know, different types of lines and, right. and signs of aging all over your face.
For all the approved uses and the safeness of it, Naturally You is somewhat ironic in that conference title, yes?
Yeah. Exactly. Right. But I think that's a big part of this is one of the reasons that people are shying away from cosmetic treatments at this moment is because there's a more natural look that's
right,
in.
Right,
I
right.
mean, if you think about celebrities like Pam Anderson and you know, you're in LA, you're there with all the right. celebrities, they're embracing aging. And so people are scared of looking unnatural. And that's one of the things that AbbVie is contending with. And so they have a new product that's called Trenibot E, and it's a faster acting neurotoxin. So it wears off within a couple of weeks. And so they're hoping that, you know, if people like them, they'll come back and just start getting Botox.
You got to innovate, man. You got to innovate. I will close mm-hmm. here, and I'm not outing you because you actually put this in Bloomberg. You know whereof you speak.
Well, so, I mean, a part of this also came from my personal experience of I am on TV sometimes here at Bloomberg and was like, wow, I'm this job is aging me. I'm really getting some forehead wrinkles here.
You should try radio. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. And so I went to a med spa here in New York and really liked the results. I was going for probably 2 years and one day looked over to, you know, at the needle and the vial that they're injecting into my face and saw that it was not Botox as I thought that it was for the past 2 years. It was Dysport, which is a different product. And I think that that sort of illustrates what is happening. And a lot of people maybe don't realize mm-hmm. that there was anything really going wrong at AbbVie at all, just because Botox is so ubiquitous and everyone knows what it is.
Yeah. Madison Mueller at Bloomberg. Madison, thanks a bunch. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Wealth Enhancement, providing its Wealth Blueprint, a plan that integrates retirement, investing, taxes, and estate planning into one plan. Learn more at wealthenhancement.com/blueprint. And by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
This final note on the way out today, which, you know, grain of salt. Bloomberg has the story that SpaceX is moving ahead with plans for an initial public offering. Mid to late 2026 is the time frame. The valuation is the interesting part. $1.5 trillion, says Bloomberg. The grain of salt, attaches not to the story, but to the guy running the company, Elon Musk's penchant for overpromising and delivering very, very late, are very well documented. Jordan Manji, Zonil Maharaj, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, and Virginia K. Smith work on the digital team around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Ray Seahorn from the new series Pluribus is coming up on Fresh Air after your traffic update starting in San Francisco. Here's Julie Deppish.
Dealing with the three-vehicle wreck, South 101 after Cesar Chavez has been blocking the right lane, slow batch the 80 interchange. Heads up for the stall in Menlo Park and northbound 280 before Sand Hill Road. It's on the right shoulder, but partially blocking the right lane. Some better news, Richmond, they've cleared that two-vehicle wreck from eastbound 80 before El Portal Drive. It's recovering back to Central. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Rising Team, creator of Super Manager AI, giving leaders at all levels a leadership personal trainer and coaching partner to help